action, and he took to it eagerly. By 1849, he had already stepped beyond Garrison's notion of the Constitution as a covenant with evil. He announced himself satisfied that if strictly construed according to its reading, the Constitution was not a pro-slavery instrument, although the original intent of the founders had made it so. Actual provisions of the document, coupled with natural law, made the Constitution a source of anti-slavery principles. History, Douglas believed, had made it pro-slavery in practice. By April 1850, Douglas still felt perplexed by parts of the Constitution question. Liberty and slavery, opposite as heaven and hell, are both in the Constitution, he wrote in an editorial. But this was precisely its radical defect. It offered no resolution for the war of elements which is now rocking the land. Douglas gave his sympathies to those who envisioned the Constitution as a source of freedom and justice, but not his judgment. He concluded that, for the moment, the Constitution was at war with itself, an apt description, as well, of his own mind. Douglas was an elastic thinker, especially about political ideology. As James Oakes has argued, Douglas's political thought is laced with a series of reversals. He would waver in response to events and to his own learning. January 1851 still found Douglas teetering between the imperatives of legal and moral logic, but much more impressed with Smith's reasoning. Confessing to Smith that their relationship had greatly affected his thinking, Douglas declared that he had about decided to let slaveholders and their northern abettors have the laboring oar in putting a pro-slavery interpretation on the Constitution. He still had some reservations as he swallowed the theory whole. "I am sick and tired of arguing on the slaveholders' side of this question," he complained, "although they are doubtless right so far as the intentions of the framers of the Constitution." Smith's arbitrary determination that because slavery was such a moral outrage, it could never achieve legal status troubled Douglas, who still wondered about the confusion between moral perceptions and American legal authority. Sheer power, he knew, still held the trump cards. Despite all his intellectual hand-wringing, Douglas assured his mentor that he had ceased to affirm the pro-slavery character of the Constitution. Douglas had argued his way to this new position, rather than merely imbibing it. Smith wrote to his pupil in June 1851, with much joy, that Douglas had accepted this interpretation. "I have observed for years that you were coming to this conclusion," Smith accurately said. But far more joyful was the student's realization that slavery is incapable of legalization, and that law is for the protection, not for the destruction of rights. They had found common ground in another kind of logic, explained by Smith tellingly. "Every man is an abolitionist. Every man is selfish enough to be an abolitionist for himself. But every man is not unselfish enough to be an abolitionist for others." In that logic, one finds both the necessity for law, but also the reason why sometimes laws must be broken. Douglas had found a new and more potent form of radicalism, but by mid-1851, he came under attack by the Garrisonians for his disloyalty to their principles. "There is roguery somewhere," cried Garrison in an outburst at the May 1851 annual meeting of the AASS in Syracuse. He laid the charge on Douglas, who, in response to a resolution declaring that the Society would endorse no newspaper that did not support a pro-slavery conception of the Constitution, announced his firm conviction that the National Charter should be wielded in behalf of emancipation. He had conducted careful study, Douglas told all his old colleagues, and from now on he planned to advance the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution in his paper. In an uproar, the convention promptly voted to exclude the North Star from the list of favored journals. Orthodoxy held the Garrisonian church together, and Douglas was about to be excommunicated. As Douglas now merged his journal, newly named Frederick Douglass's paper, with the Liberty Party, which had a firm base in western New York. His perfidy only deepened in Garrisonian eyes. Some accused him of selling out for Gerrit Smith's lucre, while others pointed to the arrogance of the new title. Douglas expected now, he told Smith, to be made an object of special attack. I know too well the temper of my old companions to hope to escape the penalty which all others have paid who have ventured to differ from them. Douglas expressed relief at no longer feeling glued to the non-voting theory, but admitted to being pained by the controversy. The war will be waged, he predicted, not against opinions, but motives. He needed money badly and appealed to Smith constantly in 1851. He felt anxious, Douglas told Smith. But Douglas was determined this time to set an example of ability to take care of myself. Inadvertently, Douglas also quietly demonstrated the other reason his old friends resented and even condemned him, as he frequently signed off letters with personal acknowledgments to Julia Griffiths, my faithful friend and co-worker. Griffiths had become not only Frederick's business manager, but his gatekeeper. Charges of ingratitude against Douglas only intensified as some abolitionists complained of their old mate's inaccessibility and arrogance. Isabel Jennings in Ireland complained in 1851 that she had heard only once from Douglas since Julia had taken over his office, otherwise receiving only requests for money from Miss J.G. Jennings worried that the situation would hurt the cause as well as Douglas's life. Miss G reads all F.D.'s letters, Jennings complained, as she snidely remarked. I am sure he thinks anti-slavery zeal is the strongest emotion she is capable of. Abby Kelly Foster, who had come to despise Douglas, took it out privately on Julia. In 1852, she snarled about that Julia Griffiths making people think we're infidels, as her boss enjoyed slandering all our English and American friends. As lulls occurred in the open conflict between Garrison and Douglas, tongues wagged in private and gossip letters flowed among the abolitionist elite, some reporting how Julia often walked the streets of Rochester in fashionable dresses and an abundance of fine jewelry. She was not a Quaker in appearance or habits, unlike many in that anti-slavery community. In May 1852, the AASS gathered for its annual meeting in Rochester. But home ground hardly protected Douglas from new assaults on his apostasy. Numerous distinguished abolitionists, all his former traveling companions and friends, spent inordinate time and energy denouncing Douglas. They included Wendell Phillips, Stephen and Abby Kelly Foster, Oliver Johnson, and the black Garrisonians Charles Lennox Raymond and Robert Purvis. Douglas had histories with all of these former comrades. He had forged his career with them on countless overnight train rides and against many a racist mob. Now they treated him, as he said, only as an enemy. Foster called Douglas a cat in the meal, and Raymond insisted the abolitionists should stop handling Douglas with kid gloves. The marked man now felt certain that his old black colleagues in particular, Purvis and Raymond, wanted to destroy his newspaper. Raymond had been the first black Garrisonian on the circuit and never accommodated to being displaced. This public humiliation hurt Douglas to the bone. Phillips and Abby Foster especially let him know that the society had not rejected him. He stood self-exiled due to his changed strategic views of abolition. His motives assailed at every level with what Douglas called vile insinuations. Stephen Foster made a bad situation worse. Douglas faced a choice. Either he was with us, or we'll crush you as we have the Liberty Party. It was one thing to fight rhetorical battles over tactics, and quite another to attack a colleague's personal character. Samuel May Jr. came forth to try to acknowledge Douglas's genius and indispensable role in the movement, stressing that he remained calm, cool, and collected, even as he withstood this withering attack. But Purvis joined Raymond in announcing that he had canceled his subscription to Douglas's paper, accused the editor of taking a bribe of $20 from a colonization supporter, and worst of all, declared it no longer safe to trust the interests of colored people with Douglas. Garrison himself stooped low into the pettiness, suggesting that Douglas had allowed himself to be lauded by avowed AASS enemies at a Liberty Party convention. These were anxious times for members of the AASS. They steadily lost adherents as they came under attack from the rising tide of political abolitionism, the new Free Soil Party, and the unprecedented whirlwind created by Harriet Beecher Stowe's best-selling novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Douglas reported in late June that Stowe's work had just sold its 80,000th copy. The book had been published in the spring of 1852 and was taking the country by storm as no other book ever had, while the old organization abolitionists vied with one another publicly to discredit one of their own for his ideas. How Douglas mustered what he called rectitude to withstand this public barrage from old friends is as remarkable as it is bewildering. On a personal level, the breakup with the Garrisonians devastated Douglas, even as he himself fueled the fires. Douglas cultivated the image of the strong individual, always questing for the next turn in the crusade to destroy slavery. And he was an intense watcher of his own life. As necessary, he would fly as the eagle, the lone bird soaring to the new horizon of ideas, rhetoric, and action. In his own slave-born ways, Douglas imagined a kind of Whitman-esque song of myself at the heart of his journey. In so many lines of that great poem, Whitman could have been imagining the struggling but determined Douglas of the early 1850s. The past and present wilt, I have filled them and emptied them, and proceed to fill my next fold of the future. Douglas had long known that he could not stay within the Garrisonian fold. Even at age 35, he was still the angry young man finding and testing the limits of his own voice. But as we have seen, he never flew entirely alone. Douglas nearly ran out of labels for the Garrisonian assault as he experienced it. The day after the Rochester Convention ended, he wrote to Smith, trying to characterize what he had endured. Treated as a deserter from the fold, he nevertheless, or so he claimed, let his colleagues search me and probe me to the bottom. Facing what he considered outright lies, he stood firm against the hailstorm of side blows, innuendo, dark suspicions, such as avarice, faithlessness, treachery, ingratitude, and whatnot. Whistling in the graveyard, he assured Smith proudly that he felt strengthened to bear it without perturbation. Such was not the case a few days later, as he wrote his long response for his paper. There he exposed his grief that men engaged in a great and holy cause should fall out by the way in such ugly form. Such differences could not be hidden, Douglas maintained, by seeming to be at peace when there is no peace. So he took up the pen and fought back. Jeremiah and Isaiah had fought best against their own kind, their roles as broken-hearted, suffering servants calling people to grief, awareness, exile, and redemption, gave Douglas models for finding his own prophetic voice, for turning affliction into hope, however many friends he might lose. In a long rejoinder to his critics, he defended his right to change his views. Denunciation, coldness, and unkindness were not arguments, he contended, and hardly the way to reclaim an erring brother. Putting several lines in capital letters, Douglas tried for high ground and struck his claim for freedom of thought and association. I contend that I have a right to cooperate with anybody, with everybody, for the overthrow of slavery in this country, whether auxiliary or not auxiliary to the American society. Here was a political consciousness at work. Douglas wielded daggers of his own, couched in Shakespearean metaphor. Drawing from Iago's contempt for Othello's unbounded jealousy, Douglas left no doubt of what he thought Raymond and Purvis especially were up to. trifles light as air, are to the jealous confirmations strong, as proofs of holy writ. He had long dismissed Raymond as his old jealous friend, then twisted the knife deeper into both of the two for their false witness against a fellow black abolitionist, and worse, for personally seeking to destroy the last press remaining in the United States wielded by a sable hand. There is no fight like a fight between the closest of comrades over notions of betrayal. Douglas could be ugly, too. He accused Raymond and Purvis of joining with every Negro hater in all the land, who would delight in liquidating Douglas and his newspaper. But Douglas's brilliant rejoinder only masked his loneliness and insecurity. He could be petty, even self-destructive, as he also found new inspirations. By July 1852, he revealed to Smith that, "You not only keep life in my paper, but keep spirit in me. I owe you much every way for my people and for myself." The paper still teetered on financial extinction as Griffiths continued to labor to get subscribers to pay up. Frederick remained uncomfortable about the constant appeals to his rich benefactor. Failure seemed always to be just around the corner on Douglas's open road, where lecturing and trying to sell copies of those lectures remained his primary method or means of living and traveling. With the bravado of a rather desperate man, he told Smith he did not want 1 cent more from his generosity. "If the paper died, when that sum is exhausted, I will submit with resignation to its death," he wrote, despite saying in the next breath that he had nursed the paper so long, had loved it, and given it half my worldly goods and the whole of my time for 5 years. Cries for help continued to burst from under those starched collars and through the eloquent rhetoric. In late 1852, allegedly because Anna ordered it, Julia moved out of Douglas's home and became a boarder with John and Mary Porter, friends in the Rochester anti-slavery community. Early the next year, Samuel D. Porter, a wealthy neighbor and friend, wrote to Douglas informing him that scandalous reports were rampant in Rochester about Frederick and Julia having an affair in his home under the eyes of his own wife and children. Douglas asked that the accusers make their claims more definite about Miss G. and me, and then he might answer them. In vague terms, he defended himself as a husband and a father, and withal, a citizen, declaring that he performed all the roles honorably. He also aggressively defended Julia as a free woman who had moved out and simply preferred to board in another family. Porter's letter does not survive, but the rumors were scurrilous by the measure of Douglas's response. "I am in no way responsible for her words, her deeds, or her dress," the embarrassed editor said, "nor indeed for her thinking me a god. But he firmly declared his gratitude, respect, and friendship for his clerk, and, awkwardly, described how they now spent only business hours for business purposes in each other's company." By summer and fall of 1853, the alleged illicit relationship exploded at the heart of a wider war of character assassination between Douglas and the Garrisonians. In the wake of the AASS annual meeting in May, Douglas suggested that Parker Pillsbury, Henry C. Wright, and Stephen Foster, prominent Garrisonians all, had stayed away because their presence might give new force to the charge of infidelity against them. Douglas had previously questioned the Christian sincerity of fellow AASS members. The charge simmered until a West Indian Emancipation celebration in Framingham, Massachusetts, on August 1st, at which Wendell Phillips publicly dressed down Douglas in front of 600 people for the slur upon his friends and the organization, wondering how his fellow orator could even show his face among old comrades. Later that month, Douglas wrote an editorial and delivered a speech at the heart of Black Garrisonianism, the Belknap Street Church in Boston. He stepped up his attack on Garrisonian disbelief in the Bible as well as viciously attacking his black rivals. To an extent, a vengeful Douglas now seemed out of control. In print and in an open meeting, he called Raymond, Purvis, and William Cooper Nell, his old friend and former editorial assistant, practical enemies of the colored people, for their loyalty to Garrison. Douglas threw some low blows. He associated Purvis, a mulatto whose white father had attained some wealth, with tainted, blood-stained riches. He considered Raymond selectively rich because he had married into money. Worst, he labeled Nell, who now worked in Garrison's office, a pitiful fool and a contemptible tool of the Boston hierarchy. From September through November, the entire Garrisonian press fired back with pent-up rage. Douglas had long exposed his persecution complex, his self-portrayal as a lone rebel, the purveyor of new truths against all the ossified doctrines of the Eastern bishop and his Orthodox priests. In writing privately to Gerrit Smith in late August, Douglas claimed, disingenuously, that he was greatly desirous of keeping out of quarrels with Boston. But they deserved a going over because of their downright bigotry and pride of position. As though baring his teeth, he continued, "They talk down there just as if the anti-slavery cause belonged to them, that no man has a right to peep or mutter on the subject who does not hold letters of patent from them." Douglas could neither hold his fire nor forget a slight. It was as though a part of his soul had forever been forged in the fight on Covey's farm, and the bloody rumbles on the docks of Baltimore, and against the countless white mobs who had assaulted him. Language replaced fists in this battle over personalities, status, and claims to righteousness. Douglas's hypersensitivity to criticism and rivalry had long been part of the personality his friends tolerated. Throughout the 1850s, Douglas publicly disputed fiercely with other black leaders over both ideology and personal matters. He fought tooth and nail with Henry Highland Garnet and Martin Delaney over emigration and colonization strategies, especially after the Dred Scott case. Their differences could not have been more fundamental, and he conducted an ugly spat with William Wells Brown in 1855 over whether Douglas had expressed derogatory estimations of Brown to mutual acquaintances in England. Their dust-up got caught in the crosshairs of the editor's prolonged battles with Garrisonians. Douglas accused Brown of attacking his integrity ad hominem, merely to demonstrate his faithfulness to the American Anti-Slavery Society. But Brown had accused Douglas of trying to ruin his prospects as a speaker in Britain with a secret, underhanded, sneaking fling at me. Both charged each other with dishonor, although the two men later found ways to make up. They shared so much. Both were former fugitive slaves who had escaped at age 20 and achieved fame as writers. As friendships collapsed and old memories crashed into new ones, Garrison complained of how extremely sensitive he, Douglas, is to reproof, how readily he construes it into personal hostility. The founder of the Liberator had tried to remain largely silent in this fight, but now he unloaded a whale of bile. In September 1853, he reprinted a Douglas editorial in his regular feature column, Refuge of Oppression, a place normally devoted to articles about the brutalities of slavery itself. Garrison said he had always done everything in his power for Douglas's welfare and advancement, and had helped to lift him to his most eventful life. But now he found Douglas intoxicated by his fame and cursed by selfish ambition. Garrison wasted no adjectives. Douglas's attacks on Phillips were exceedingly base, and his treatment of his fellow black abolitionists would be disgraceful to a barbarian. The student had overstepped his bounds. Garrison tried to take the high ground, claiming that the dispute was not about ideological change, but about Douglas's alienated temper and spirit. But then Garrison attacked Julia Griffiths and accused Douglas of the worst immorality. Garrison called Julia a prejudiced sectarian Delilah, endorsing the storehouse of rumors. For several years past, he, Douglas, has had one of the worst advisors in his printing office, whose influence over him has not only caused much unhappiness in his own household, but perniciously biased his own judgment. The youthful black wonder of abolitionism could never have altered his worldview without a conniving white woman at his ear. When Douglas answered in defense that Julia had opened his eyes to many ideas, and that Garrison's handpicked runners and whisperers had all along sought to stifle him, things only got worse. Like a Shakespearean court intrigue, defamations and insinuations flew like autumn leaves in the fall of 1853. Oliver Johnson, editor of the AASS newspaper and a newly contemptuous critic of Douglas, called Julia a Jezebel whose capacity for making mischief between friends would be difficult to match. As Douglas issued lengthy denials and refutations of the charge of marital infidelity, Johnson could only wreak more damage. He saw Douglas merely as an exhibition of moral perversity, blindness, and malice. No one involved remained untouched or unembarrassed by the scandal. Anna Douglas produced or dictated a short letter to Garrison, which the editor published. "Sir, it is not true that the presence of a certain person in the office of Frederick Douglass causes unhappiness in his family. Please insert this in your next paper." Garrison was unimpressed by the brief denial, calling it evasive, although he soon openly regretted that he had ever raised the marital question. For her part, Julia hardly sat on her hands or went into seclusion over the scandal in which her name was a constant byword for intrigue and adultery. We do not know for sure what she or Anna might have said to Frederick. We do not know who may have confronted whom, nor if anyone did. But we do know that Julia worked hard to create the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society of Rochester, of which she served as secretary and guiding force. Even more extraordinarily, Julia produced and edited two remarkable volumes under the title Autographs for Freedom, the first published in 1853 and the second in 1854. These stunning collections of short essays, poetry, and letters, which included Douglas's own 65-page novella, The Heroic Slave, all written by celebrity abolitionist authors, were not only unique in anti-slavery literature, but became yet another moneymaker for her comrades' cause. These volumes required enormous correspondence and editorial labor to bring to fruition. They included some 36 authors in the first volume and 49 in the second, almost all of whom were squarely in the camp of political abolitionism. Those authors also demonstrate that Douglas had another and even wider circle of friends, thinkers, and co-workers apart from the Garrisonians. The scandal did not die out in 1853 without sufficient public and private recrimination to fill a year's worth of script for a modern soap opera. Purvis wrote a letter published in The Liberator in which he dismissed Douglas as a shameless ingrate and base slanderer. Wounded badly, Nell, a sensitive and loquacious man, frequently wrote privately about his pain over Douglas's statements. "I cannot easily imagine the circumstances that would result in my speaking to him," he lamented. "I can remember the sunny side, and only wish I could forget the shady side of his character." Nell remained shocked at Douglas's venom in his attacks on Garrisonians, especially on himself in battle axe style. "Where will he stop?" Nell moaned. After reading Douglas's long defense in December, Nell said he couldn't help saying, "Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad." By January 1854, the Garrison loyalist, happy in his day job, criticized Autographs for Freedom as an anti-Garrison creation by the FD with JG contingent, but then secretly confessed to a slight wish I could have contributed. Douglas left his mark on the scandal as though he strove for the last word. He crafted a long, alternately turgid and eloquent defense in his paper on December 9, 1853. He also reprinted many columns of the articles that had appeared over the months in the three primary Garrisonian papers, Liberator, National Anti-Slavery Standard, NASS, and the Pennsylvania Freeman. Writing at times like a lawyer with a veiled threat of a lawsuit, and then like a wounded, lonely warrior defending himself against his enemy's hatchet of fratricidal war. Douglas did not provide his finest hour. He could not resist venting his spleen. The Garrisonians' aim, he said, was to drive him from the field, to send him back to caulking ships in New Bedford. They sought nothing less, he claimed, than the moral extermination of one humble, solitary individual. The line-by-line attempts at rebuttal gave the whole effort a sanctimonious tone. Not without some reason, the editor of the Pennsylvania Freeman, Rush Plumley, called Douglas's tone a whine of persecution. Douglas claimed that he had tried to sustain honorable silence, but the assaults had become unbearable, especially about his private affairs. Garrison had seen fit, wrote Douglas, to invade my household, despise the sacredness of my home, to blast me in the name of my family. His denial of any affair with Julia took the form of a defense of Julia's eminent services as his co-worker, and a prolonged 8-part declaration that the happiness or unhappiness of his household was nobody's business but his own. He denied the affair as he continued to contend that he was under no obligation to do so. With thousands of highly charged words wielded as daggers to the heart in this sordid affair, inevitably it became racialized. With paternalistic pique, Garrison had argued that Douglas, as a former slave, could perhaps no longer comprehend the full demands of abolitionist leadership. The anti-slavery cause, said the founder, both religiously and politically, has transcended the ability of the sufferers from American slavery and prejudice as a class to keep pace with it, or to perceive what are its demands, or to understand its philosophy. Philosophy? From the first days that Douglas's early Garrisonian colleagues had tried to monitor and manage his thinking and his actions, here was the attitude that Douglas had spent a decade resisting. He pulled the arrow out of his chest and fired it right back at Garrison's heart. Is it their own liberty that black people will next be told they do not comprehend? He asked. This was an old subject for the former slave, but now he gave it new sting. For black folk, said Douglas, every day and hour is crowded with lessons to them on the subject, to which the whites, as a class, are strangers. In effect, he was saying to his old dear friend, if you want this fight, I will destroy you. Personal insults and judgments about morality were one thing, but an intellectual insult cut even deeper. Who will doubt hereafter, Douglas anguished, the natural inferiority of the Negro, when the great champion of the Negro's rights thus broadly concedes all that is claimed respecting the Negro's inferiority by the bitterest despisers of the Negro race. Douglas's demolition of some of the Garrisonians' accusations would have left an open-minded reader wondering just who were the egotists or the alienated spirits in this row. The tragic dimension of this mutual self-destruction is manifest in such exchanges between two men who had loved and served each other, who had learned so much from each other, the one a father figure, and the other a prodigal son in a life-affirming cause. But words can kill, and sometimes love and hate ride together. It is an ancient story, faded and repeated down through the ages in variations on Abraham and Isaac, or Cain and Abel. Both Douglas and Garrison lived to see their travail redeemed a decade later, in the freedom of the slaves, even if they fundamentally never made up. In November to December 1853, as the Garrison-Douglas War came to its Baroque conclusions, both protagonists paid separate visits to Harriet Beecher Stowe, newly ascendant to extraordinary literary fame. Although political crises and broader events overtook the petty inhumanities of the breakup, Stowe took it upon herself to call a truce. In November, Garrison had exchanged long letters with Stowe over her objections to the tone and theological outlook of the Liberator and some of its agents. She had worried that the unrelenting criticism of churches, ministers, and pro-slavery religion carried on by Garrisonians would take from poor Uncle Tom his Bible. Stowe wanted peace in the ranks. On December 19th, she wrote to Garrison of her recent face-to-face meeting with Douglas. She admitted to earlier contributing to gossip about Douglas's personal life. She now found Douglas most impressive. He did not seem malignant or revengeful, and had only been caught up in a temporary excitement. Douglas must have charmed the observant author. Poignantly, she described Douglas's ideas as the growth from the soil of his own mind, and not a twig broken off other men's thoughts. She thought him no more to blame than his accusers. "Where is this work of excommunication to end?" Stowe demanded. She found all allusion to his family concerns unjustifiable. She pleaded with Garrison for silence and suggested tellingly that what Douglas is, really, time will show. Presciently, Stowe scolded Garrison. What he had cast aside as worthless would one day be a treasure. Stowe seemed to be telling Garrison what he ought to know, that genius often makes superhuman demands on tolerance. In this wrenching period of his bitterly public split with Garrison, Douglas had thrown himself into the worlds of political abolitionism. Through physical and emotional collapses, and through the ever-invigorating and debilitating lecturing tours, he found the time and repose to assist numerous fugitive slaves toward their liberty, to begin a sustained and brilliant critique of the slave power in national affairs, to write his first work of fiction for Griffith's Autographs for Freedom, and to now craft the greatest speech of his life at the invitation of Her Ladies Anti-Slavery Society of Rochester. Chapter 13. By the Rivers of Babylon. I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms, to root out and to pull down, to build and to plant. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 10. Frederick Douglass had learned the hard way that oppression, loss, and anger had to be controlled and braced with knowledge if a former slave with an extraordinary mind was to survive in the United States. He was a man of the 19th century, a thoroughgoing inheritor of Enlightenment ideas, but for justification and for the story in which to embed the experience of American slaves, he reached for the Old Testament Hebrew prophets of the 6th to 8th centuries BC. Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel were his companions, a confounding but inspiring source of intellectual and emotional control. Their great and terrible stories provided Douglas the deepest well of metaphor and meaning for his increasingly ferocious critique of his own country. Their Jerusalem, their temple, their Israelites transported in the Babylonian captivity, their oracles to the nation of the woe to be inflicted upon them by a vengeful God for their crimes, were his American Republic, his bleeding children of sorrow, his warnings of desolation soon to visit his own guilty land. Their story was ancient and modern. It gave the weight of the ages to his cause. Their awesome narratives of destruction and apocalyptical renewal, exile and return, provided scriptural basis for his mission to convince Americans they must undergo the same. The Old Testament prophets helped make Douglas a great ironist and a great storyteller. They fueled his growing militancy and brought pathos and thunder to his voice, as they also shaped his view of history itself. Douglas not only used the Hebrew prophets, he joined them. The Hebrew prophets delivered their sayings and poems orally in public gatherings. Whether Douglas understood this or not, it makes his oratorical use of the Jeremiadic tradition all the more poignant. As Isaiah came and said, and Jeremiah followed God's call to go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, so Douglass proclaimed anti-slavery oracles to vast public audiences in pro-slavery America. God had visited Jeremiah and instructed him, "Behold, I have put my words in your mouth," and given him his calling. Beginning with the black churches he attended in Baltimore, where he would have first heard preaching on the Exodus story, Douglass had reached that moment as well. He was an American Jeremiah, chastising the flock as he also called them back to their covenants and creeds. Moreover, Douglass, like other American writers and orators from the Puritans to modern times, found his own way to comprehend as well as rewrite Old Testament narratives, in the words of biblical scholar Robert Alter, as both sacred history and prose fiction, as models of literary style and a national story. And as the Jewish theologian Abraham Heschel wrote, "Prophets must have been shattered by some cataclysmic experience in order to be able to shatter others." By this standard, Douglass qualified. In early summer 1852, surrounded by rumors about his relationship with Julia Griffiths, suffering periodically with ill health, and embroiled in his fight with the Garrisonians, Douglass was invited by the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society to deliver a 4th of July address in the majestic Corinthian Hall, only a few blocks from the North Star's office. Maria G. Porter was president and Griffiths the secretary of the society, which in late March had raised $233 at a festival to support Douglass's newspaper. The society sponsored a regular series of anti-slavery lectures in Corinthian Hall, announced by Griffiths in Douglass's paper. In accepting the invitation, he insisted on delivering the speech on July 5th, which had long been a practice among New York State African American communities. In the South, moreover, slave auctions had often been conducted on July 4th, further sullying the date in African American memory. The 4th fell on a Sunday, and for that reason also, the Rochesterites moved it to Monday. For at least 3 weeks in advance of the event, Douglass worked hard on the text, as well as personally promoting the event in his paper. He clearly aimed the speech not only at his local audience, but beyond the hall to the nation at large. Immediately after the oration, he had it printed in bulk and sold it in his paper, as well as out on the lecture circuit, at 50 cents per copy, or $6 per hundred. What Douglass crafted and delivered on July 5th was nothing less than the rhetorical masterpiece of American abolitionism. Nearly 600 people packed Corinthian Hall on that warm July day. A grand dinner was prepared by the Ladies' Society for after the speech. The beautiful edifice, which took its name from four Corinthian columns adorning the high front wall, had just opened in 1849 and was Rochester's most prestigious venue for concerts, lectures, balls, and fairs. Four great chandeliers hung from the high ceiling, and tall windows on both sides admitted plentiful natural light. The buzz of mass conversation quickly fell silent as local abolitionist James Sperry called the meeting to order. The Reverend S. Ottman of Rush, New York, delivered a prayer. Then the Reverend Robert R. Raymond of Syracuse performed a reading of the Declaration of Independence. Without introduction, sporting his high white collar, vested suit, and large mane of hair carefully parted, Frederick Douglass stepped forward, his hands slightly trembling with the 30-page text he held. In a conventional apologia, audiences came to expect. He began quietly with a disclaimer of his ability to address such an august assembly. He had never appeared more shrinkingly before an audience. He knew such disclaimers were taken by his auditors as flat and unmeaning, but he begged their indulgence of his awareness that this was something special. He knew he spoke in the house of his friends, whom he now used as stand-ins for the nation. In an old move of false self-deprecation, he said the distance between this platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable, and left him with a quailing sensation. Wishing he had time for more elaborate preparation and more formal learning, Douglas finally reached his subject. Invited to participate in a celebration of American independence, Douglas delivered a political sermon steeped in the Jeremiah tradition. Douglas's 4th of July speech came in the midst of many turbulent contexts. Douglas faced the personal crises of his own life just discussed, and Uncle Tom's Cabin had become an instant phenomenon. For nearly 2 years, free blacks and their allies had defied the hated Fugitive Slave Act. Massive protest meetings condemned a law that denied the right of habeas corpus and trial by jury to alleged fugitive slaves, as well as threatened the kidnapping of free people of color into slavery. Douglas himself had stepped up his assistance to runaway slaves in Rochester and participated in recent months in some of the clandestine rescues of fugitives across the North. Now, under the American flag, observed Douglas, so deep was the fear in northern black communities that hundreds had fled to Canada like a dark train going out of the land as if fleeing from death. In virtually every issue of his paper, Douglas and his staff ran articles and reports about kidnappings or escapes of refugee slaves in the North or into Canada. And as abolitionists turned more toward violent means of resistance and political parties began to tear themselves asunder, the country faced another general election in the coming fall. Douglas channeled all of this tension into a kind of music. His speech was like a symphony in three movements. In the first movement, Douglas set his audience at ease by honoring the genius of the founding fathers. He called the 4th of July an American Passover and placed hope in the youthful nation, still impressible and open to change. 60 years and 10 is the allotted time for individual men, said the calm Douglas, but nations number their years by thousands. As he began a historical tribute to the bravery of the American revolutionaries of 1776, subtly referencing Thomas Paine's times that tried men's souls, he dropped hints of foreboding, of dark clouds above the horizon, portending disastrous times. He began with hope, though. There is consolation in the thought that America is young. Great streams are not easily turned from channels, worn deep in the course of ages. Douglas called the Declaration of Independence the ring bolt to the chain of your nation's destiny, and the preamble the nation's saving principles. With active, gleaming metaphors landing on his listeners in every spoken paragraph, the music became louder. From the round top of your ship of state, dark and threatening clouds may be seen, Douglas sang. Heavy billows, like mountains in the distance, disclose to the leeward huge forms of flinty rocks. That bolt drawn, that chain broken, and all is lost. Cling to this day, cling to it, and to its principles, with the grasp of a storm-tossed mariner to a spar at midnight. His baritone voice now projecting to the rear of the hall, Douglas had laid the groundwork of prophetic irony in the first movement for the main argument to come. The scene-setting beauty of the string instruments soon gave way to full-throated horns and kettle drums. The warnings already lay in the politicized possessive pronouns, your fathers, your national independence. America's story of its founding and the Revolution and its aftermath was taught, Douglas intoned, in your common schools, narrated at your firesides, unfolded from your pulpits as household words, the staple of your national poetry and eloquence. A voice truly free and independent had arrived. Then, as though slamming his fist down on the lectern, Douglas announced the shift to the second and longer movement of the symphony, a new version of that national poetry. Quoting Longfellow's poem, A Psalm of Life, he announced that his concern was the present. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act, act in the living present. Heart within and God overhead. As Douglas reminded his largely white audience of their national and personal declension, the speech found its theme, the hypocrisy of slavery and racism in a republic. He hearkens to Genesis and Exodus, and the 12 children of Jacob boasting of Abraham's paternity, but losing Abraham's faith. This great human folly was both ancient and modern, Douglas proclaimed. The children of Israel contented themselves under the shadow of Abraham's great name, while they repudiated the deeds which made his name great. For Americans, said Douglas, George Washington was the Abraham of their new Israel, and though Washington had freed his slaves in his will, his monument is built up by the price of human blood and the traders in the bodies and souls of men. Complicit in the oldest stories in their spiritual and national lives, the audience sat primed for the onslaught to follow. The oracle turned wrathful. Now, Douglas brought his hammer down even harder, and for approximately 14 pages, the second and longest movement rained down like a hailstorm. He pulled no punches, making the good abolitionists and the Ladies' Anti-Slavery Society squirm as he dragged them through a litany of America's contradictions. Second-person pronouns crashed into his singular I. Fellow citizens, he firmly stated, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Douglas personified all slaves, past and present. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? Then, in the most beautiful move in the speech, he warns that there is a parallel as he flows unannounced back to the captivity of the ancient Jews in Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there, they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Douglas's answer to the summons? He would not sing any praise songs on the nation's birthday. Instead, he recrafted Jeremiah's tales of God's wrath and the people's mourning as he proclaimed, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions, whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. Douglas loved the Declaration of Independence, but since its principles were natural rights, like the precious ores of the earth, he refused to argue for their existence or their righteousness against the claims of pro-slavery ideologues. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? He asked. Why must he prove that the slave is human? Rather, Douglas claimed his authority from two great scriptures, the Constitution and the Bible, and announced that the time for argument is past. Instead, the American condition demanded scorching irony. Douglas had not come to Corinthian Hall for polite discourse. Oh, had I the ability and could I reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And so for 25 minutes, the second movement, he did just that. Douglas poured out a litany of historical and contemporary evils caused by American slavery. He did not merely call Americans hypocrites. He showed them and made them feel, see, and hear their revolting barbarity in aggressive language. First, he delivered a thoroughgoing condemnation of the domestic slave trade. As lyrical as it was terrible, Douglas made his audience look at the human flesh jobbers who operated the slave markets, hear their savage yells and blood-chilling oaths, the fetters clank and the crack sound of the slave whip, and indeed see the slave mother's briny tears falling on the brow of the babe in her arms. He forced them to attend the auction and look on the shocking gaze of American slave buyers. No one could do this quite like Douglas, who personified the terror by telling of his own memories of hearing the rattle of chains and the heart-rending cries from the slave coffles along the docks of Baltimore. Douglas next blasted the Fugitive Slave Act and the pro-slavery stances of American churches. The new law demanding complicity by Northerners in the retrieval of fugitive slaves, he told his countrymen, transformed your broad Republican domain into a hunting ground for men. Everyone must now practice this hellish sport, including your president, your secretary of state, your lords, nobles, and ecclesiastics, as a duty you owe to your free and glorious country. Withering sarcasm, indeed. The sheer corruption of the Fugitive Slave Act, which mandated paying commissioners double the money for consigning a runaway back into slavery, as opposed to allowing his freedom, could only be matched, said the orator, by the flagrantly inconsistent practices of the churches, who willingly served as the bodyguards of the tyrants of Virginia and Carolina. In Douglas's unrelenting staccato, labeling the tyrant-killing, king-hating, people-loving, democratic Christian defenders of the Fugitive Slave Act were no better than the pious scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, who pay tithe of mint, anise, and cumin at the temple, rather than act with mercy and faith. Far too many clergymen, said Douglas, mouthed the words of the Declaration of Independence, but in their religious practice only abetted the tyrants, man-stealers, and thugs. So he pulled Isaiah from his arsenal and delivered what he believed the churches deserved. Bring no more vain oblations. Incense is an abomination unto me. The new moons and Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I cannot away with. It is iniquity. I am weary to bear them. And when ye spread forth your hands, I will hide mine eyes from you. Yea, when you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Seek judgment. Relieve the oppressed. Douglas bore the news that the nation's crimes stood condemned by the prophets of old in the people's own sacred texts. Douglas brought the second movement to a close in classic, frightening Jeremiadic style. After one final long list of the ways slavery brands your republicanism as a sham, your humanity as a base pretense, and your Christianity a lie, he begged his audience and the nation to break loose from their doom before it was too late. Oh, be warned. Be warned, he shouted. A horrible reptile is coiled up in your nation's bosom. The venomous creature is nursing at the tender breast of your youthful republic. For the love of God, tear away and fling from you the hideous monster, and let the weight of 20 millions crush and destroy it forever. With such urgency and terrifying imagery, Douglas took a breath and paused. The short and final third movement began calmly, with a firm embrace of the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution. That charter, though full of potential double meanings, was in Douglas's view a glorious liberty document, full of principles and purposes entirely hostile to the existence of slavery. There was still time to act, and legal and moral tools aplenty for his countrymen to save themselves. In a move common in the American Jeremiad, Douglas ended with visions of hope. He counseled faith in three elements that had now taken root in his thought. First was the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution. Second was his oft-expressed belief in divine providence, in the idea that a moral force would in the end govern human affairs. Seeking again his justification in Isaiah, he confidently asserted, "There are forces in operation which must inevitably work the downfall of slavery. The arm of the Lord is not shortened, and the doom of slavery is certain.